Facebook tries to find meaning in your posts. Jeff Bezos puts a little human in your Kindle. We talk Chrome cookies, security, why Google should worry about your health, and more. That's coming up on this week's episode of This Week in Google.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Google, episode 217, recorded on September 25th, 2013. The Human Clippy.
Google is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is reliable domain name registration and management that's simple, honest, and easy to use. For exceptional customer support and 10% off your new domain name, go to Hover.com/twig and use the offer code TWIG.
This is TWIG, This Week in Google, the show that's all about Google, the cloud, Android, mobile, social, Twitter, Facebook, privacy, publicness, and any topic related to all of that. I'm Gina Trapani, and I'm standing in here for Leo, who's off recharging his batteries on an amazing European cruise. But I am joined here by my amazing co-host, Mr. Jeff Jarvis. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Gina.
Jeff is the author of What Would Google Do? And Public Parts, and a professor of journalism at City University of New York, my alma mater. We've also got with us today as a guest on our panel, Mr. Kevin Marks. Hey, Kevin.
Hi there. Nice to see you all again. I've been away for a while. I was in the UK for a couple of weeks, and then last weekend I was at XOXO, so I've been not paying a lot of attention for a few weeks, which has been good.
That's okay.
We're so glad you're on the show.
Yeah, we have missed you. Kevin, you're currently at Salesforce, but you've been at Apple and Technorati, and you've basically worked everywhere in the Valley. So you've always got all kinds of insights into what's going on.
Yes.
How was XOXO? All of the reviews I've read of XO is that it was great.
It was very good again. They managed to pull it off a second year running, which is quite impressive. And again, it was very good. Focus conversations about making things, about independence, but also a very great set of people and a great atmosphere where you could actually talk to them. I had a lovely long chat with lots of people who've made things and built them, and you know, you come away refreshed and inspired. And Andy Bauer's closing thing was say, okay, yeah, you've all been inspired, but I'm not going to do another one of these unless you actually do make some things this year. So you're on notice, which I thought was very good. So I'm going to go and make some things now. Stop hand-waving as much. Write some more code.
Yeah, that was what I heard a lot of people saying. They came away feeling really inspired. I'm so upset that it was the second year in a row I had to miss it. The first year was because the baby was born, and the second year was because it was her birthday weekend. So I'm hoping that they're not going to schedule it for that, you know, the weekend of the 19th next year. All right, let's see. Let's dive into some Google news. It looks like Google's tightening up security across all of its searches, even the ones you're not signed into. So it used to be, or in October 2011, they launched the feature that if you're signed into Google and you do a Google search, it's HTTPS, encrypted SSL. But they're rolling out kind of quietly the HTTPS or SSL across all searches, even if you're not signed into Google. And kind of relatedly, they're also sort of tightening up security in Google Chrome. They're increasing the restrictions and standards they expect SSL certificates to meet for Chrome to not show that, you know, that little the dreaded red page that maybe this isn't a site to be trusted. So Danny Sullivan over at Search Engine Land was saying that this, you know, this might be a response to the NSA leaks, or this could be just Google, you know, doing what it does, which is kind of raise the standards for security across all of its properties, which it has really sets a good it's been setting a good precedent over time. Does this matter? Do users notice this kind of thing? Does this it kind of screws up some of the stats that you get about what people are searching for because those searches are encrypted.
That's a problem, but I had breakfast this morning with Alan Rusbridger, the editor of The Guardian, and you know, he's doing magnificent work there. And my thought to him was that the NSA story is going to shift from Washington more and more and more to Silicon Valley. And whether it's a telephone company or a hardware company or, you know, a Cisco, that is to say, or a consumer service company like Google, I think there's going to be a lot of calls for more information and accountability from these companies. They're going to have to try their best to protect us from our government. And so I'm betting if maybe this was always in the plan for Google, but I'm betting it got sped up because of the NSA.
They'd always been very good at offering encrypted searches. And Matt said as much when we had Bruce Schneier on, that it was listening to him that made them think about that more. And they've obviously stepped up this over time. They've always had perfect forward secrecy for a while, which makes it much harder to intercept their stuff. And they've been doing a lot of work on actually tracking SSL certificates and when they change as part of crawl, to make sure that people can't, inject new certificates into certificate authorities, which is something that has been an attack vector that's happened recently. That was part of the recent defacement attacks. We're using techniques like that. So there's definitely a stepping up there. And my sense from the people I know who work in the security space is everyone's going through and being, doing even more auditing and paranoia than they have done previously because of all the threats and allegations that have been going around.
Right. I mean, honestly, when I saw the story, I was surprised when I didn't realize that if you weren't signed into Google, your searches weren't encrypted. I had assumed that all of them were encrypted. I mean, I'm pretty much almost always signed into Google anyway, so it didn't occur to me that if you weren't signed in, that it is encrypted. But now it is, I think, which is a good thing. So it seems like this is a combination of both a response to the NSA leaks, but also just a kind of incremental security upgrade, which I feel like Google is kind of always doing.
So Gina, back to the other point you raised. So because it's encrypted, then the metadata that used to pass along with the search isn't there anymore because it's not known, or it's known in Google, but Google's not going to reveal it. Is that what you're saying?
The referrers go away.
Yeah.
The referrers and the search request go away.
Well, the search request was always part of the referrer. That was how you used to get it.
Okay, I see. So, okay, right.
Because the previous page would then be, google.com?q=, whatever you search for. And
That harms media companies, I think, to an extent. You're right that they can't. But the problem is, very few that I know of actually targeted anything at that end.
WordPress did quite a lot with it at one point. I'm not sure if they still do that. They may have moved away from that. But WordPress would look when you did that and serve ads when it got one of those and not when it didn't. And that was their way of distinguishing between the direct readers and the people who had got there through search. And they used that as a way of doing their incremental monetization.
And about.com. About.com certainly used it because that was the basis of their business. I don't know what it does to that. And Google also used that too. Now there was something about not encrypting ad, and I didn't understand what that meant because Google definitely uses search requests all over the web, obviously for placement of appropriate ads. And I can't believe they're going to.
So I think they may still be using yes. So this is where we need to ask Danny probably, but I think that if you've they still know that they referred you there, and therefore, and they can. They've then got a back channel to ads that they've embedded that can respond to that. So they can do.
Well, so is that kind of unfair advantage for Google that they know what you searched for, nobody else does? They can serve an ad, but if I wanted to use the referrer to serve a targeted ad, now I can't.
Well, you can still do cookie tracking and foreign cookie tracking. So you can still do the kind of I can't really call them, but basically the ads that follow you around the web. That still works because if you're using an ad service, that knows where you've been before and what
right.
you've done
well,
before.
Right. Well, that's
but that's not quite
Kevin,
the same
that's
as
that's an ad service
search
that does that apart from the publisher, right? So if the cookie follow you around the web, then you know that. But if the publisher is not part of that service, the publisher now gets less data. I mean, it's a really good point, Gina.
Right, that publishers don't see the search terms when they're encrypted, right? So with privacy comes like invisibility to publishers who can't, customize their content as well, right? That not provided referrer information has gone up quite a bit, actually. Danny's got a chart here on the Search Engine Land post. up to 73%, almost 74%. Is search traffic where the referrer isn't provided. So it does sort of put publishers in a bad position, but it's certainly a good thing for users.
Didn't Google pull back on referrers like 2 months ago or something? I think we had a story some time ago about how they made a change in it. I wonder if it was anticipating this. I can't remember what the change was.
I'm not recalling.
Well, I don't want to jump around the rundown, but somewhere in here is a story about more efforts to find out a little more, speculate a little more about Google replacing cookies.
Yes, the Wall Street Journal reported that ad companies are nervous. They're nervous about the cookie getting replaced.
So this is a similar issue that Google may have more information. I mean, this is going to get a little dicey in terms of unfair advantage questions. I think replacing the cookie with something better is a good idea. But if that plus this means that Google knows more about every search, you know, I've said to publishers that what they should be asking for from Google is not money in Europe, but is more data about their users so they can serve them better. And if now that data is not passed along, well, it's going to be a little rough.
Yeah. The cookies thing is partly this, is that we have other ways of, better and improved technology for storing information at the client side now. So a lot of people are moving away from cookies because you can actually use HTML5 storage and things like that, which now... That means that each site can do that and is up to a certain size, but it's certainly bigger and less clunky than using cookies was in the first place. I suspect it may just be that has become, you know, the browser footprint of that has got big enough that forcing everything through the sort of narrow barrier of cookies may no longer be true. It's still true that sites can store information on the site about you, and as they know where you're coming from, they can tell information about that. So they can still broker information back and forth between them. Just a question of the mechanisms that were there that just meant you had to include an ad in a certain way and it would happen may need changing. But you know, there's a gigantic industry full of people who are busy working out ways to do this.
So it's time for Jeff's dumb question. We should have a theme for that. cookies were invented to hold state on the stateless net. So is state held now through HTML5? How is it held?
You can still hold it through cookies. What you would normally do with cookies is store a session ID, and then you look up the user in your database on the server side. Say, I recognize that session ID. That's this user. So all you would be storing on the client side would be some opaque number. What can be done is you can store actual data there and then feed that straight back in. So you're not trying to store anything on the server. So that was another technique for using cookies, but there were limitations to how much you could store in that. What's been added since are various HTML5 client-side storage things that let you store something more database-shaped at the client side and use that directly. And people have started using that to do, I suppose the original root of this was Google Gears, if you remember that, where that would help you do offline things. And that's been going through a bunch of different standards iterations, and there's a couple of different variants of how you can do this now. But broadly, you can store... a reasonable sized amount of data at the client side, I think it's about 5 megs without the computer asking you, which means that you can store some documents and things like that rather than just like a few keywords. So if you actually want to use it for storing keywords, that's relatively straightforward and should be unobtrusive and is actually less fragile than cookies, I'd say, because when that exists, it's usually in a more modern implementation and there's more interop between browsers around that.
Do I get? I mean, cookies give me at least some level of visibility into them, and I can see the list of them. I can kill cookies. I mean, I can erase cookies, block cookies, and see cookies.
Yes.
Is there that kind of visibility and transparency in these other technologies?
Yes. Yeah. If you look in settings, you'll be able to maybe in advanced settings, you can poke around and find that and say no, this site can do this, no, that site can't do that. So it's almost as obscure. Understanding how to delete your cookies is a fairly advanced skill, and it's similar with this.
Okay,
you're going to have to teach a user how to do this.
I mean, last week, I think Kevin, we talked about the new, or week before last, Leo was here. It was the new Chrome apps that can now be resident on the desktop and can have more access to your computer. And Leo was worried about the security issues of that. Is there more moving onto the browser now? Is this a trend?
There is to some extent. I mean, there's always a trade-off between computational power and access to the machine. That's so. What's happened is that we're getting different sets of tools to do this and different kinds of sandboxes. With a lot of the big exploits we've had over the last few years have been through the existing sandboxes, through using Java. through using Flash, through using, you know, other plugins, and exploiting flaws in those widely installed plugins to take over the machine. So what we're seeing now is, rather than having that boundary between the browser and the plugin, is that the browser itself and the specification itself is much more defining what you're able to do and what you're not able to do. And that's because those are both more standardized and more open source implementations, modulo Java to some extent, that means that we get to eventually have better security and transparency around them. And also,
they'll
be designed learning from the sandbox problems we had. If you think about the difference between the kind of sandboxing you get on Android or iOS and the kind of sandboxing you get on the Mac or Windows, there's as we build new platforms, you get more ability to separate different bits of the computer from each other. It comes down
to... Let me ask you a question.
Sorry, yeah, sure.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
So it comes down to moving from effectively a sort of C dispatch model where you're passing around pointers into memory back and forth with the assumption that the programs will share them well, to a more API-like capability-based model where you say, I would like to do X, and you get a bit of API you can call that does X. Some of those X's may still involve direct access to the machine or bits of the machine and memory, and there may be a way to break out of those. But in general, there's more isolation installation there than there was in previous computer designs. And there's more, and given the amount of grief we've had with exploits and viruses and machine takeovers and malware over the past 20 years, at the point where these things are designed, there's a lot more thought that's gone into them. Certainly,
let me ask this question then.
Okay.
So you WebKit is open source, right?
Yes.
And are Chrome and Firefox built on top of it open source?
Yes. Chrome. So Chrome forked off the... The names are slightly fuzzy, but basically Chrome forked off its... There's this piece called WebCore, which was the piece that they were actually both using, and then WebKit was Apple's wrapper around that, and Chromium was Chrome's wrapper around that. And they forked that now, so there's less shared code, and there'll be less shared code over time, but they're both still open source at that level.
So here's my question.
Firefox has a completely separate code base that has had for years that's open source too. So we now have three at least, and there are some others as well, but three widespread independent open source implementations, which is good for this.
Right. So here's my question. If something's open source, that's what gives us confidence that the security can be audited in terms of NSA and other bad guys. Is there stuff that's Is there stuff that's built on top of that base on Chrome or on Firefox that's more proprietary, harder to audit, harder to get into? Is that an area where, and I'm thinking NSA, it's easier to have exploits?
There are pieces that are built on top of this in all of the platforms, because there are the bits that are the proprietary runtimes and the platform specific runtimes, as opposed to the shared code. And there's boundary layers, there's like encapsulation layers around this. And there are places, there are bits of the Chrome code that Google doesn't publish. There's Safari code that isn't published. I think Firefox does still publish all of their code. And similarly, there are bits of iOS and kind of bits of Android. This is the discussion about Android versus Google Play services, which I think you covered that a bit a couple of weeks ago when someone was talking about that.
We have discussed it, yeah.
But that is a distinction between code that Google doesn't share and code that Google makes open source and anyone can use. So where you can audit is, if you're looking to exploit, you look for attack surfaces at all these places, and you look at the boundaries between them, and can you persuade this thing that you are the other half, the other side of that boundary? So there's lots of, the value of creating the API boundary is that you then know what that attack surface is, and the possible drawback is you can then put something else in between that pretends to be that thing and simulate it.
Right. Someone on Twitter this week, it was Kurt Henzel, said something really made me really think. I thought it was really insightful. He asked, is Chrome aiming to be Google's Play Services on the PC? So where Play Services is the kind of proprietary layer on top of open source Android that provides, you know, the hooks into Google's services and Google's cloud services. And of course, there's the layer of closed source Google apps like Maps and Gmail and Calendar and all that. You know, is Chrome aspiring to be that on your desktop computer? Because, you know, like last week we talked about standalone apps, Chrome apps that run on your desktop and that, you know, show up on your taskbar, your desktop, you know, that don't live necessarily inside a browser tab. And I thought that was a pretty interesting comparison.
I mean, I think that's, you know, that's always been there. I wrote a blog post about this called Two Faces of Android probably 3 years ago now, which was about this distinction between the piece that's open source and the piece that sits on top and requires a biz dev deal. And when it's a web service, these days the web services tend to require some kind of biz dev deal to let you use them. You may have some open variant of that. You may be able to use it for a bit, but if you actually want to use it seriously, then you've got to make sure you've got an API key, you've signed a TOS, and you're open to revocation at arbitrary times. And this is one of the challenges of this. You know, one of the values of doing web services in this way is that you can provide this, you can couple things back and forth, and you have a fairly good idea who's calling you. But the drawback is you're then, you know, it can be revoked for other reasons than terms of service reasons, or they can arbitrarily change the terms of service on you and stop you getting access to them, which is something we've seen have going back and forth between Google and Facebook and Twitter in various combinations, and also various, you know, other apps that suddenly get their permissions revoked because they were threatening that. And we saw it between Google and Apple to some extent as well previously. So there is the challenge is what piece are you able to compile any code and run against it, and what piece are you able to isolate and separate? And both of those, you know, but both of those double-edged swords. If you can compile arbitrary code, that's great, but that also means that you can do arbitrary things to the computer and take it over. If you can call services and have permission and revoke it, that means you can shut down malware quickly, but it also means you can shut down people for business reasons. So there's always a dance back and forth between the two, and it is one of the themes of XOXO was independence. And the weekend before, I was in Brighton for Indie Web Camp UK, and that's a group that is trying to say, no, we want to build a web that has this independence and isn't won't break if one of these large corporations decides to revoke something. And that's the challenge of, can you build something that takes advantage of those services but will not break completely if one of them shuts you down? And that's in some ways, that's one of the more interesting like technical conversations that's going on at the moment, is wanting to take advantage of the things that Google or Facebook or Twitter or anyone, you know, Salesforce, anyone like this who has large numbers of services that they provide, but not wanting to be so dependent on them that they can shut down your entire business.
Yeah, no, that's a huge challenge. That's a huge challenge. If you think about a web without Google on it, if Google just disappeared today, you know, there's so many things that would not work across the web. I mean, and I'm not just talking about consumer products, right? I mean,
Jeff particularly would be in trouble there. Yes, as he's put his eggs in that basket.
You know, this is why I find CyanogenMod, or becoming a company, Cyanogen Inc., becoming a company, so interesting. Yes. Because I think that they're really reckoning with this, right? Like, they're this open source project, this mod, this kind of Hacker Weekend thing, and now they're in a position where they're trying to get Google certification, and they had to reckon with the, you know, really, because of CyanogenMod, that's the only reason why I realized that Gmail, Maps, and Calendar were all closed source apps that ran on top of Android. I didn't even realize this, but it came to the forefront when Google sent a CND to CyanogenMod back in the day, in like 2009, and said, hey, you can't include this zip right onto your installer. So it'll be really interesting to see how they handle that. But
what does Google think of Cyanogen? Gina, what do you think Google thinks of Cyanogen?
Well, you know, there was that one kind of public kerfuffle back when they sent the CND and said, hey, you can't distribute Gmail and Maps because they're closed source, you know, that your users have to get them separately. And I think that kind of shook the community, the CyanogenMod community at the time. I think since then, things have gotten better between them. And if I'm not mistaken, Cyanogen Inc. has actually hired like a former VP of business development from Google to work with it. So they've got kind of someone who was on the inside at one point, and they're working toward getting Google certification right now. So, you know, it's in their best interest to have a good working relationship with Google. And I mean, I think that I see it as a good thing for the Android ecosystem. I mean, if Google was averse to someone forking Android and making another build of it, they wouldn't have made it open source to begin with.
Right, right. I guess it's the same relationship that Xiaomi has.
Yes.
Right.
Or, you know, I guess in a sense every. Well, let me. All right. This dumb questions continue. This is the dumb question show. What Samsung does to Android, is that a fork? Or is that
no?
Just cruft piled atop?
Depends which bit of Samsung you're talking about, right? Because they've got several things going on in parallel. So when they do the skins on top of it, that isn't really a fork, but it's changing some of the libraries and the presentation layers. So there's extra work to link. It's another closed source layer, if you like. There is also the Samsung OS project, which is a fork of Android that I've forgotten the name of. But they've been working on that for a while and had developer conferences for that and building phones that use that. So that's another project where they are building devices that don't have any with Google component on there. So they wouldn't have the Google Play services blob on that.
And Amazon is clearly a fork.
Amazon is... I think... I'm not sure. Yeah, that's a bit...
Or is it just a build with lots of things erased?
It's a piece. It doesn't have the Google Play stuff. Clearly,
no.
Right. So it doesn't. It's not Google certified. Yeah.
And it's, what I don't know from they just released Fire OS 3, and I haven't seen anyone
what
say
makes a,
what
makes
where
a fork a fork versus just a modification.
That's a good question.
A fork starts off as just like a separation of code. And the question is, at some point, it's like what constitutes a species. At some point, you can't make merges between them anymore, and then it counts as a fork, I think, when they can no longer reproduce. So if once you
their DNA are different, yes.
The thing is, you know, a fork is just saying, I'm going to make some modifications to this. So, you know, at the base level on GitHub, there's a fork button, and you press that, and it makes a copy of the thing, and you build it yourself. And until you change anything, it's like a fork in name only. And then when you change something, it's a fork. And you can then send the changes back with the pull request, and then the other person can decide whether to take them or not. The way Android has worked is that they don't take pull requests from anyone. They just drop a new release every so often. And so your ability... So in effect, anyone who's trying to keep up with Android is probably working with a fork, or they're on the special deal with Google where they've got advanced access to that, and the release is going in. But what happens is generally is that when Google does a new code drop, the various people who've got variations on that theme then have a sort of giant merge fest until they've got it working again. So it's what I don't know is what Amazon has what bit of Android Amazon Fire OS 3 is based on, whether it's on 4.2 or 4.3. I haven't seen anyone note that yet.
I didn't realize they were calling it Fire OS. Is that actually what they're... So they're calling it Fire OS. They're not saying... They're
yes.
not calling it Android.
Fire OS 3.0 Mojito is what they call it.
Mojito?
Yes.
Huh. I had no idea. Well, you know, I just updated my app in the Amazon App Store, and on Amazon, it clearly says, like, these are apps for Android. And it was funny because I was updating my app description and I was like, oh, should I not mention Android? Should I only refer to Kindle Fire? So I was like, no, any Android device can get the Amazon App Store on it, right? So it shouldn't be,
yes.
You know, it's not the Kindle Store.
Yeah.
It's not the Kindle Store.
In order to maintain that, they need to make sure that they are still compatible. So but the question will become, you know, are you using Play services? If so, then you won't work their side of the fence. Are you using some of these other bits and pieces? You know, some of the compatibility libraries may fail. So it's like you know, any development, you're always linking against something. It's a question of, is that piece there for you to link against, or is there a shim that lets you pretend it's there? And I think Amazon's approach has been that they're adding bits for their own stuff, but they're not adding third-party APIs particularly that I've noticed, but I haven't actually looked at it in great detail.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible that the Fire OS Mojito is an untouched version of the Android open source project with a layer of Amazon stuff kind of built on top of it, which you could argue is not a fork because they haven't changed, right? But they're not merging polls back into, they're not submitting, you know, Kindle specific changes back to Google, and Google's not merging them, and they're not even trying for Google certification. They don't want the Play Store on there, right? They just want the Amazon App Store, right? So because it's an Amazon buying machine. But you know, it is interesting that Google Play Services really does kind of edge out app compatibility. It hadn't occurred to me that if I hook into Google Play Services as a developer, that makes my app incompatible with the Amazon App Store. That's not that big a deal to me because, frankly, the revenue that I make from the Amazon App Store is a very small fraction of what I make from the Play Store. But yeah, that's interesting. In fact, when I submitted my app to the Amazon App Store, they have a suite of automated tests that must fire up simulators or devices, and it spit back a report that said, okay, the Kindle Fire, this version, that version, that version, that version, pass, pass, pass. So they're clearly like running you know, some sort of tests, you know, for the app against each one of their devices. And I hadn't really thought about Play Services that way. You know, when Google says, hey, developers, like, hook into Play Services, here are all the things that you can do, they're also saying, hey, your app's only going to work on Google-certified devices from here on out, right? Because it won't be compatible for devices that aren't Google-certified.
Go ahead,
Kevin.
So far, the value of Play Services has mostly been access to Google specific stuff, but one chunk of it is maps. So if that's not there, you may get some other map stuff, and they got to shim the API out. But the other bits are mostly store specific stuff, or they've got an API for trying to get you to do multiplayer games and high scores and things like that. Mm-hmm. And Google Plus is the other piece, of course. Yeah. So the sort of social API that's there in Google Plus. So there's bits in there. And you know, they're adding Drive, they're adding other bits and pieces where this gets more, you know, you're able to take advantage of these things if you sign into Google. And the auth stuff is getting more significant because that is that's a valuable time saver when you're using Android. You don't have to type stuff on the gadget. It'll just say, do you want to sign in with Google? You say yes, and you get this like smooth one click integration thing.
It's a huge user experience upgrade for sure.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that piece is definitely something that makes a big difference to your app, and it means you have to write a bunch of extra code if you want to say, oh, and I'll let you sign in with Facebook independently and that kind of stuff. So
right.
there's a set of pieces there. The other thing is that comes with this is a lot of the things that we think of as part of the Android experience, which is, you know, Gmail and Hangouts and Maps and big chunks of that experience and sense of whichever Android I use, this stuff is working. The other what do they call the messaging thing? The Google Cloud
Hangouts?
Messaging. Google Cloud messaging. So the subtlety of that, of making it such that when you dismiss an alert on one of your devices, they get dismissed on the other. All those letting you write that stuff server side rather than client side polling and things like that, which we take advantage of, you know, Google's cloud services. But that means that's tying you close to that, and basically you need a Google account attached to it for that to work. So there's this sort of set of things that mean if you've got a Google account attached, this has to happen. So that's the piece that they've got there. Amazon doesn't seem to have offered quite as much of that, but I haven't actually built my thing for Amazon yet. So do they offer you, you know, login type stuff for the Fire and ability to access their pieces when you do that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. When you get a Kindle, you sign in with your Amazon account,
right?
So really, where Amazon really has to compete, and really now Cyanogen as well, is that layer, right? Like you're signing in with your account and services associated with those accounts, and they do have to offer hooks. Of course, Google has a huge head start on this because they've just been at this a lot longer than anybody else, and in a lot of ways that's their advantage. But as far as I know, I'm not sure. But honestly, I wouldn't build that unless I was building a Kindle-only app. I wouldn't build that into my app because it would limit the way that my app worked. My app wouldn't work on Google devices, which is the majority.
Right. Well, that would be the challenge is, could you use something like OpenID Connect and have that work across both of them? You know, Google has implemented that. I don't think Amazon or Facebook have implemented that yet. So that will be one challenge there. The other thing about Amazon is that they've got... I encounter this because, you know, the reason I was off for 2 weeks was I was going to the UK with my son, who's going to university in London, and he's doing English literature. And so we got a whole bunch of books to buy. And my first reaction was, great, we'll buy them on the Kindle, and that'll save you carrying books around, and
yeah,
you know, and your notes will be digital, and that'll be wonderful. And then I realized Amazon UK and Amazon US deliberately don't interoperate. In fact,
because of copyright issues, yes.
Because of mechanical interpretations of copyright issues. I can buy physical books from either country and deliver them to the other country, and that's okay, but I cannot do that with the digital books. What you have to do is set up an Amazon account, dedicate it to a particular country, and only log into your Kindle with that Amazon account. And if you switch it, it deletes all your books and your notes. So my weekend project is going to be working out how to do this with two Google accounts and two Amazon accounts on the same...
Oh, God, the two Google accounts alone will kill you.
On Nexus 7. Well, no, two Google... We can have two accounts on here because you can switch between them easily.
Actually, you're right. Google accounts are a lot easier on the tablet than it is in the damn... Don't get me started.
I'm not going to do the Google Apps for the main thing because I know that will break the universe. I'm going to just do a Gmail
Go ahead.
Oh, but that's somebody in the chat says they figured it out. Put notes, please. What I'm going to end up doing is making a new Google account that I then attach to a new UK Amazon account, and then both myself and my son can log into our independent tablets with that, so that we can buy books and
another
stuff
thing
by
you
default.
Can do, Kevin, is that on the new version of the tablet software, you can have two different users on the same device.
Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah.
So you're going to have one UK user, so one has an accent and one doesn't.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can do that with Chrome, and you can do that with iOS. Not iOS. You can do that with Macintosh. You just can't do it with iOS. And you can't do it on most of the phones. But he's got a Kindle. He's got one of these. And we can work out how to do that. I'm not sure you can do it on the Kindle device. He's going to have to pick one for that. But as long as he's got access to both of them on this. Because the point is, he's starting to mark up books this way and take notes on it. And that's actually a very useful feature. But it's... The worry is that your notes are then stuck in an Amazon cloud, and if he's trying to write an essay and the Amazon cloud goes down, all his notes disappear. Or if he accidentally switches to the wrong one and deletes them, then bang, all the time he spent highlighting the book is gone. And given that
Amazon, meanwhile,
degree, and it's more significant for him than it is for me.
Amazon, Bezos sat down with some tech journalists, and the thing they're showing off, have you seen this? I didn't put it in the rundown. I just put it in the chat section to the side. Amazon May Day.
I haven't seen this.
So this is new. This is, and Bezos gets all excited. This is the way Bezos thinks about service, right?
Yes.
So if you have a problem, and of course, if you have a problem, then that's a problem itself. But you hit May Day, and I think at first you get a video, but then you can get connected directly to a video chat with a customer support person who can take over your tablet if you give permission to do so, and can fix problems. Which sounds good. It has the air of a human talking paperclip to me. a little bit of clippy to this, because how many problems do you really have with your tablet? And if Kindle is so well controlled, you know, Bezos is talking about how this is a kind of a life changing thing. Good to have service. Good to have direct service. I'm all for that. But I think that if tablets are designed the way they're supposed to be designed, they're supposed to be the easy devices. I don't have problems with my tablet. I promise that I can't connect it to Verizon. Can you fix that? But
I saw my friend snarking about tablet, but Bezos shipping tablets like filled with tiny people who want to help you. I hadn't connected that this is it. I mean, customer service on this level is one way that Amazon can differentiate itself from Google, right? So there's that. I agree. I mean, how often? I mean, hey, I would love. You know what you should do, Kevin? You should start screencasting software. You should get your son set up with his books. And then you should dial up one of these helpful Amazon customer service people and ask them how they can ensure that your kid's notes are never going to get lost. Because I have to tell you, I was an English major, and I hauled around the old, Norton anthologies on my back. If I had had an e-reader, that would have been way, way better. But I can't imagine losing all my notes and highlights. The very thought gives me the willies. I'm a little worried for him.
I have the slight problem that when I go to the Amazon, it says which device you want to send your book to, and like this thing pops down that's like 35.
Yeah, this is this drop down of like every device that has
every
Kindle
Android
on it.
I've ever touched. You know, Kevin's 15th Android phone. It says or something. Yeah. Yes, this is okay. This is a working on the show problem, but they do only let you have copies of the books on 5 of them, and if one of them dies, it's the same as the iOS problem. If Andrew
really?
Broke one of his, and we were able to get the books onto another one, but we've used our copy now, and the one on the broken one that we can't access anymore counts as a copy, which means if I try and look at a book with him, I've used up another one, and suddenly we're getting close to the edge of how many copies of Beowulf.
You can't just kill an old device. Can't you kill an old device?
I haven't found out how to yet. This, as I say, may be one of these.
Well, just hit the Mayday button, Kevin, and ask.
Hit the Mayday
nice
button.
Little person.
Well, I have to find the Kindle Fire. I've got an original Kindle Fire somewhere. I have to find that. Hit the Mayday button on that. But yeah, the other problem is I'm not sure which one is the old device because it's just called Kevin's Android
That's
tablet 43,
yeah.
And it's like which one of these has which copy of which book?
That's why I never send a book to a device. I only pull the book from the device.
Pull it manually. That's probably smart. That's probably really smart. So let's zoom out a little bit to just sort of the big business decisions Google's been making. Last week, we talked about Calico, which is Google's new startup that's going to attempt to lengthen the human lifespan, right? And I was saying right here on the show that I thought it was great that they had this long-term vision. And, you know, if Google isn't going to make these kinds of, investments into the long-term future, you know, who is? And I love this kind of, like, long thinking. Well, over at Wired, Ryan Tate, I thought, made a really good point. His piece is called "Dear Google, Shouldn't You Worry About Your Own Health?" And Tate's point is, if Google can't invest the time and resources to keep projects like Google Reader running, for example, you know, what makes them think that they should invest in such long-term things like health? So now, I brought this up because I knew that it was going to make Jeff.
This was such a specious, short-sighted, right in front of your nose argument. It's a variant of this. It's a variant of the argument that Bill Gates made to Google when Google wants to bring connectivity to the world. We'll solve water first. You can only do one thing, right? So this argument is, don't save lives, save Reader. Come on. Come on. What a ridiculous argument.
I agree. But, Page himself is the one who said that Google's all about focus and more wood behind fewer arrows and spring cleaning every few months, shutting down projects left and right.
And as he said, I watched his talk to Zeitgeist, which I can never get invited to. But I'm not mad at you. I'm only mad at Verizon. But we'll get back to that. And so he said, yes, of course, it's insane. Whenever everybody thought we were insane, I was insane to do a self-driving car. And for that matter, I think that Maps at first was a moonshot. What all Maps can do today is unbelievable. We take it for granted. This is like going to be a Louis C.K. routine here now. But it's unbelievable what Maps can do, and it also has incredible value to the business. Right? It tells Google where we live and where we work. My own newspaper, local newspaper, doesn't know that, but Google does. So Maps eventually becomes part of the business. That kind of thinking would have, from that publication of all publications, would have shut down Bell Labs 50 years ago. What transistor? Who needs that? We have. What does that have to do with phones? Phones are simple. They use switches. Don't do that. Unix wouldn't have had Unix. Why are you wasting your time on that? Can't you make my phone work?
Right.
We should thank God or Google. What will Google do? Joke. That this kind of research and long term thinking, as you said last week, Gina, this very long term thinking is going on. And he's already proven that if something doesn't work, he will kill it. He will get rid of it. And I'm sorry you don't have Reader. Try Feedly. Nah, nah, nah.
It wasn't that Reader didn't work.
Reader.
I'm grumpy about Reader. I'm over it.
It's a fair argument
because it broke a bunch of other things.
Google, nothing to keep Reader running, right? And it was like, we're shutting Reader down because we're moving on. It's the past and it's not the future. And I actually completely believe that because I don't use an RSS reader myself, and I believe that. But you can see how you have Google, you know, shutting down and concentrating on short-term, well, I shouldn't say short-term folks, but focusing their products, but then making investments. Now, Calico is a separate company, isn't it? It's a separate company outside of Google. So they're kind of investing in it.
Yeah, and in the same way that some of the power ones are. You know, they've got a bunch of investments in those kinds of things as well. Yes. So they have these long-term things. They tend to put them in independent companies, probably precisely so they can isolate them from this kind of speculation.
The rule is very simple here. Google makes more money the more we use the web. Okay, now let's logically extend that. The longer we live, the more we use the web.
Right. Yes. The longer we live, the more we use the web,
the more money Google makes.
Right.
That's actually a really irrefutable argument.
Immortality is good for Google, right? It's the old argument. If it's good for GM, it's good for America. If it's good for Google, it's good for all of us. That's basically the argument.
Our argument is like, if they've got a self-driving car, you can surf the web while you're driving, which is good for Google.
And yes, it is. And it's also, Google knows where you go. Google can use these things for its not to jump around, but for its delivery service that they just launched today in Mountain View. Self-driving cars can have a lot of impact on Google. You know, what I'm disappointed in. I would expect, this kind of dorky thinking from the Wall Street Journal or somewhere, but this is Wired. You'd think they'd have a more strategic view. Science comes along, innovation comes along, and Google's talked about this. They don't sit down and think ahead to the full business case use of something. They're willing to explore and invest in it. And again, I'm just glad they are, and I'm glad Wired ain't running the world.
See, here I was. I thought we had a couple of guys who were reckoning, who were facing their mortality in a midlife crisis, and out of the goodness of their hearts, they wanted to extend people's lives because they just like humanity. But it turns out they just want us to surf the web longer.
It's greed, Gina. Pure greed to keep us alive longer. That's all. We're gonna be hooked up to machines, and they won't let us die. It's the opposite of the death panel. Google's gonna have the life panel. Google's gonna keep us alive, whether we like it or not, forever. No suicide allowed in Google land. Did you see, by the way, there's a new island that popped up in the latest earthquake right off Pakistan? I'm thinking that's Larry Page's island that he talked about at I.O. Right? Let's put all of Google's servers there, and we can go there, and Google can keep us alive forever. We'll be hooked up to things, and we'll be happy. I swear, I'll be happy.
We don't actually even need bodies. You could just kind of put our brains in jars, and we could just kind of like live on the web, through Google.
That's right.
Aaron Levy had the best two takes on this. His first one was, Larry Page, why are 1% of our customers churning every year? Business analyst, death. I see. You know what to do.
There you go.
And then his other one was, Google letting you live forever is their little way of saying sorry about Google Reader.
We can't keep you, Reader, but we'll keep you alive for a few more years. Right. So you can experience the future of news discovery. So speaking of companies or sites that Google has funded or has been involved in, which has a much more clearer business sense to me anyway, is the Constitute site. It's constituteproject.org. This is a website which has archived every single constitution currently in force across the world, with ambitions to make available every constitution that's ever been in force across the world throughout history. This is pretty amazing. I actually didn't realize that it wasn't possible to look up any country's constitution, but apparently it was not until this site came along. So if you go to constituteproject.org, you can browse by country, or you can browse by topic, and you read any country's constitution. And this was funded partially by Google Ideas, which is kind of their Google's political think/do tank, they call it. Pretty neat site. And this clearly aligns with Google's mission of organizing all the world's information.
And our rights and principles. And let's not forget that Iceland, well, first, there were some old friends of mine, Iranian friends of mine, who tried to create a wiki rewriting of the Iranian constitution way back in the day. It was like a decade ago, which I thought was a great idea. But Iceland, to a great extent, did that. It open sourced and opened up, at least, the writing of the constitution, which I think was a very cool thing. And so now to see the best of breed in here and to see what rights are protected and not, when we break down national barriers, I think it's a nice thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How about free speech in there, Jad?
I'm just smiling because the United Kingdom isn't there, so.
Oh.
Because you have no constitution, you fools. You need a First Amendment, especially now with GCHQ.
We do have Magna Carta, but...
Yeah, it's old.
And the 1688 Bill of Rights, but yes.
You need to move beyond the 1.0 there.
Yeah. No, it's true. The UK is not there. I haven't searched short for Great Britain. Hang on, maybe... The other problem is, what the hell do I search for to find my country?
There are a couple options.
United Kingdom, Great Britain, Northern Ireland would be the thing I would search for, but I don't see it.
No constitution.
Yeah, no written constitution.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys experience any email delays yesterday in Gmail? Did you go a few hours? Yeah, me neither. I think I get a lot of email. Honestly, I'd welcome a 7-hour break from email however many hours it was.
That's how I treat email anyway. It's like, okay, I'll look at this sometime.
Well, this is the thing, right? Email is not, it's not IM. It's not instantaneous. It's asynchronous. But on Monday, Google said that less than 50% of Gmail's user base, which to be fair, 50% is a lot of people, people were seeing email slowdowns where messages weren't arriving in a timely fashion. Again, I don't know what timely is. When I send an email, I assume it has to sort of wend its way across the internet to arrive in someone's inbox. But messages weren't arriving in timely fashion and some attachments, I guess, weren't downloading. But Google apologized. Apparently a couple of their networks had gone down at the same time, which is sort of a rare occurrence. And they said that the average delivery delay was 2.6 seconds. I mean, really? Do we care about this? 71% of messages were unaffected. But it's just interesting that people have such talk about dependence, right, on Google, have such a dependence on Google. It's like anything happens with Gmail, a lot of people notice right away. But also this expectation that email will get delivered, you know, instantaneously.
That is like the Louis C.K. routine when he makes fun of people who complain that they can't use their Kindles on the airplane when it's taking off. He said, listen, you've got your butt attached to this huge machine and it's flying. Isn't that enough?
Everything is amazing and no one is happy, Jeff. It's true.
Yes.
It's true.
Yes.
It's true. It's like when, you know, when the iPod launched, it was like, yeah, but it doesn't have expandable storage. And it changed the world. So what else do we have here? Oh, so Google Glass. It's interesting. Google Glass was a Google X project, right? But part of me thinks that maybe Google Glass is going to be one of those spring cleaning projects someday. But
really?
I mean, I don't think we've come to that place, but I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, I mean, I think we're still going to see the glassware.
I think it's a really good point. Larry said at the conference that I don't get invited to, that he thought that Google Glass was just super and just great. So
I'm very excited about
Google Glass. Well, but that's what he says today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it turns out Glass isn't going to get released in Europe very soon anyway. I mean, it sounds like we've been hearing rumors that, you know, there's going to be a Glass store and it'll probably be available to consumers here in the U.S. next year. But in Europe, there are privacy concerns, which I'll let Jeff explain
about.
No,
it's okay. I'm
but
tired.
Also,
I'm
interestingly, that the voice recognition doesn't the voice recognition on Glass doesn't work as well on people with foreign accents.
They could fix that.
They've got to be able to fix that. They've got to be able to fix that. That's
what I
want to
know, Gina, is when you're home in Brooklyn, how well Google Glass works versus when you're in California.
I'm sure that when I'm in Brooklyn, Glass would be a lot more useful because
I'm asking about your accent. Whether Glass will understand you. Yeah,
I was talking about sort of the denseness. I mean, the need for, you know, directions and just spending a lot more time walking. But my accent. That's right. As soon as I'm around my family, Glass is gonna knock and recognize my OK Glass commands.
Yo Glass.
$5. Come on.
Yeah, I think it's like, excuse me, Glass.
Excuse me. Right.
if it's not too much trouble, Glass.
Yeah. Or the Canadian version. I'm sorry, Glass.
Sorry, Glass. Tell me a boot. So let's see. What else do we have? One last story, and then we'll go on to the change log. The Google Science Fair winners were announced. Yeah, I will have to introduce myself. These are the Google Science Fair. Teens faced down flu viruses, energy crises, and the winning Google Science Fair entries. I love this. Smiling teenagers holding what look to be Lego trophies.
They're great trophies. They're Lego trophies, yeah.
Very, very cool.
I love those.
Very, very cool trophies. 17-year-old winner of the Google Science Fair. The young researcher, Eric Chen, he worked on accelerating the development of new antiviral drugs that could save lives in the science fair. Very, very cool. There's a few really cool stories of teenagers.
There's one girl, I think one is one we had on that we showed a video on the show months ago where she has the human heat powered flashlight.
Oh, yeah. The flashlight that's powered by the heat of her hand. She was brilliant.
A cool kid.
Very cool. Very, very cool. All right. What do you say? Should we break out the horns?
Yep.
Chad, you ready for the change log?
The Google change log.
Loving it. All right, we got a bunch of changes going on in Google Land this year. Oh, this week, excuse me, this year. YouTube announced a new commenting system. It's powered by Google Plus. It's going to feature threaded, ranked, and private conversations. So Google's trying to tackle the commenting problem that YouTube has. So this is going to be launching on channel discussion tabs this week, and it'll roll out to all videos over the next few weeks and months. So basically, the new system is going to automatically rank comments and feature threaded and private conversations based on a variety of factors. So comments from the video creator, for example, will be ranked very highly. The system will push comments from popular personalities on YouTube and people in your Google Plus circles higher up in the comment chain. So you'll see the stuff that's more relevant to you sooner, as well as highly engaged discussion about the video. So if you have a really active thread going on. And just like before, you'll be able to vote comments up or down, and those votes will influence ranking as well. This is going to be a huge shakeup of the YouTube community.
Yes. I remember going to the YouTube person in charge of comments in 2008 or so and saying, hey, social comments, think about that. That would be a really good thing instead of just sorting them by time. And he was like, I don't know how you could do that. But the sheer volume of comments on YouTube is so much bigger than anything else that they tend to throw their hands up. But giving people, I think the other part of this is it's giving more control to the people who post the videos to be able to moderate their comments rather than just like being drowned in complete flame and ghastliness as soon as you post anything. So I think that's important. This sort of fits my sort of tumbling thing of tools for tumblers, letting people have more control of the conversation by giving them better tools to do it. So I welcome this. I'm looking forward to this and improving the nastiness that is YouTube comments. But the challenge is that because that culture is already in place, it's going to take some real work to shift the culture. That's very hard with any of these systems.
So were you asking Chad too, Gina?
Yeah, I mean, Chad, you're really active on YouTube. You do a show this week in YouTube. I'm sure that this is that people on YouTube are going to freak out about this. This is a huge change.
Yeah, this is really exciting because also like what I do is whenever I make a video, I share it almost immediately on Google Plus, and it always feels like I'm cheating either myself or the other fans that there are comments all on that post that never see the light of day on the other video. And sometimes I even mention like, oh, in the next video, oh, on Google Plus, someone commented and said this. And I always do feel like I'm cheating the YouTube audience for not, you know, maybe they feel like I'm not paying enough attention. On top of that, a few weeks ago, Google deprecated the video responses on YouTube. And this seems like this may be what they were teasing way back then when they said, we're going to give you new ways to connect. So maybe this will even allow for a video comment. That would be really cool. I hope that would be cool. Yeah, if you mention something, you can do something else. That's pure speculation and just a hopefulness. But this is really neat for YouTube creators.
I mean, I know that when YouTube sort of started to ask users to link their Google Plus account, which requires real names, to their YouTube account, that there was a lot of backlash. A lot of people didn't like that idea, right? Because they didn't use their real names. They wanted to just keep their YouTube handle. And I think, and Chad, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that that's still optional. I don't think you have to.
at the moment, they've been pushing it a lot more. In fact, it got to the point where every single time I went to YouTube with a classic YouTube account, that it would ask me every single time I went to just YouTube.com. And so I ended up switching. There's definitely still a little bit of pain on my end, there was. But I think that I switched it. You have the choice of either creating a, especially if you want to keep that username, you have the choice of either creating a page that you could add managers to, a Google Plus page that you could add managers to, or using your profile. And there's pluses and minuses to each of those. And that's where the sort of pain comes in, is that I wanted managers to help with the channel, and so that I wouldn't have to give people my Google password, which is now my Yahoo or my
Gmail
password. It controls everything, right? But then also, I don't really need a page for myself, because I'm already myself on a different on Google Plus. So there was a little bit of confusion there. So that's why there's an OMG Chad on Google Plus, and there's also a Chad Johnson on Google Plus at the moment. Yeah.
I wonder if with this change, if you post a video to both to YouTube and Google Plus, if those comment threads will mirror, like if someone makes a comment on Google Plus, will that also show up on YouTube?
So
no, they have to be separate threads.
Yeah, what I'm hoping, and based off of the screenshot, is that if you share it on Google Plus, it will have whatever you enter into the text box as a comment. So if you say, well, you know, like if I post on my channel and I say, you know, I made a vlog and I had a great time with such and such and such and such, that will show up as a comment. And then anyone who comments on top of that post will show up underneath as the replies, which is sort of what this image is suggesting.
Oh, via Google Plus.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's the via Google Plus, which would be whatever you write in your descriptor, and then these replies are the replies to the post. And of course, it's not going to strip it'll strip out the embedded video, which shows up on the Google Plus page.
Right.
So that's
right.
How I imagine it to work.
Oh, that's really cool. So you have everybody commenting on the same content, and so everyone gets to see everybody else's comments.
Right.
So you're not going to have the problem that you have where you're like, over at Google Plus, somebody said this.
Exactly.
Because you can have private comments. You can set it up so that the Google Plus comments are just to a circle.
That's the other...
Whatever the other thing's called that isn't a circle that you have too. Community. You can still have forked comments, but the ones you see will be the ones that you're... The circles or communities that you're members of.
Yes. So imagine you send it to your family circle and you say, you know, this is the local sheriff department talking about this thing. And then you could just trash that sheriff. You could make fun of him. And only your circle of family, if they go to the page, could see those comments because that's all you shared it with.
Right. So look at this idiot. Yeah. And not everybody will see that. Got it. I like it. I'm excited about it as a non YouTube user. I assume that this is going to be just a big change for the community and culture there. And I expect that people will be upset about it when it happens. But I think it'll make
The ones who are going to be most upset are the trolls, and so I think that's kind of okay.
And they
also the fact that you can use Google Plus comments now on YouTube and also Google Plus. The other thing, when I shared this on Google Plus, I said that I really would like to be able to put this on my blog. And have the comments there work across both, which would be great. And Bradley Horowitz, and I put his name in it, Bradley Horowitz, the head of Google Plus, responded, interesting idea. So,
that's always, it seems like that's always Bradley's response. And then we get a goodie a few months down. Yeah, a few months in. All right, so keep an eye.
If only there was an API for those.
If only. So moving along with the change log, Google's got a new flat logo. Everybody's getting flat. New flat logo and an app launcher style nav. That's going to be official, and it's rolling out over the next few weeks. So I'm not seeing this in my logged in Chrome, but I opened up an incognito window and just went to google.com and saw this. So basically, here's a change. The black bar that used to run atop all of Google's properties, that's going away. In this redesign, the black bar has been replaced with a new menu. It kind of sits next to the share and account information. It looks like the grid of boxes, which is the same button which launches apps in Chrome. Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Chad. Right there. Yeah.
Android.
So they're kind of unifying this. This is how you get to the rest of Google. And I have to say, I'm not sad to see that black bar go. So
I agree.
You'll see the black bar leave your Google.com homepage and other Google properties over the next few weeks. Gmail for Android got a little update today or last couple of days. It's actually, I think it was today or yesterday. Just a little redesign, updates with the leaner conversation view and improved multi-select. So it's much easier to select multiple conversations and see that you're going to perform a batch action across many conversations. You tap on the user icon in order to do that. Also, if your account sync is off, you'll get a big notification at the top of the page that Chad's showing off right now, telling you that account sync is off and you should turn it on in order to get new messages. Google Wallet makes its iOS debut, and this is without NFC support. So the payments app is now available for iDevices, and with it, you can transfer money to friends, you can track loyalty card activity and nearby offers. Tap to Pay doesn't work on iDevices because they don't support NFC, but you can do basically everything else that an Android user can do on iOS now. And if you lose your phone or tablet, you can disable the Google Wallet app remotely on the Google Wallet website. Also on iOS, Google Translate for iOS adds handwriting support and a new UI. The new UI is just redesigned for iOS 7. And now, just like you can do with Google, you can input characters via handwriting. So you can tap the handwriting button and
handwriting wouldn't work.
It's a slow input method, but it works and is now available on iOS.
Can you type Chinese characters?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the example. Yeah.
Now that would be cool.
Yeah.
Make sure you get it right though.
You've got it can't be too fiddly. Oh, and it looks like we have a late entry. Oh, thanks, Jeff. Google starts supporting Google Plus hashtags in search queries. Oh, look at this. So you can search on regular Google.com search. You can search for a hashtag, so like Emmys. And it will return. So now does this return web pages with the hashtag in them or with the word? It looks like
And Google Plus, when you ask for a hashtag, it doesn't just give you the hashtag. It gives you, I think, things that it knows are relevant.
Things that it knows are relevant. Right. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, very cool.
But
wow.
Of course, ideally, this should include Twitter feed. But of course, that marriage went asunder.
Yeah, unfortunately, it should. You're right. And actually, somebody would do well to make and this would be a very simple Chrome extension to make, is to embed in an iframe or some such a Twitter search for that hashtag as well.
Well, the answer to the question is, if I search for hashtag Emmys, the second result is just the plain old Emmys site.
Right.
It looks like it's not in the normal. It's only in the cards over on the side.
No, if I search for hash XOXO Fest, which was the hashtag for XOXO, it finds everything but G+, which is kind of fun. So it finds Instagram photos for that tag. It finds them on app.net. It finds them in Tantec's site because he's IndieWeb. It finds the hashtag on Tumblr, but it doesn't point to Twitter. It points to the account, the XOXO account on Twitter, not the hashtag.
Oh, interesting. So that was the knowledge graph area on the right side, like the Emmys example.
The Emmys, they know what. Yeah, clearly XOXO Fest isn't in knowledge graph.
Oh, this wait. Hold on here, folks. So this is interesting. I did the wrong version of the search. Okay. So now I'm seeing a constantly updated feed of things from Google Plus. So you don't get that? I get that. But yeah, the box we're seeing on the right.
If I search for Emmys, it does.
Getting updated. Yeah. My point is this. This is going to be controversial with those who say that Google uses a monopoly, like the soon-to-be former president of Microsoft just said this week, and those who say Google can't use its page to promote itself. Of course, as if the New York Times uses its page to promote the Washington Post. It doesn't. But that'll be an interesting.
It sounds actually live there. This is just scrolling old ones. A search for Emmys is like 7 hours ago, 4 hours ago, 7 hours
ago.
That's
true. Well, no, but it may be relevance, not time. I don't think it's time based.
Yeah. Then why make them scroll?
Why are they scrolling? That's a good question. I think maybe just to show me that I can scroll. because there's a scroll bar there.
I press scroll.
It is clearly not everything. This is clearly chosen by some algorithm. Of course, Google Plus always is chosen by an algorithm. Idiot. Sorry.
Right, but the content on the side, that right column, does not appear for every hashtag. So it appears for Emmys, and I tried, you know, individual shows, right? But XOXO Fest, which is a pretty popular hashtag on Twitter, probably not as much on Google Plus, doesn't have that right-hand column. Right, even the hashtag XOXO Fest on app.net shows up.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I've got this one here that is... probably what they said. This is for you, Emmy Ellison, and then they have a rotten e-cars full of swearing. So this is a wonderful example of Google inserting the hashtag Emmys, even though it is somebody whose name is Emmy. Yep.
Oh, the cat hashtag is pretty awesome. I feel like Sarah Lane is going to love this. Aww. That's all I got. That's all I got for the changelog.
Oh.
Sorry, Chad.
So I found another one. I've actually seen this reported, but I found it when I clicked on Chrome on iOS 7, which maybe this happened 2 weeks ago and I didn't notice. But they've got a new thing that says reduced data usage. Have you seen this?
Oh, the Chrome compression. What's it called? It's got a name. It's got kind of a clever name.
I
it's
yes.
Google's proxy for Chrome traffic that will compress it for you and will reduce internet traffic. That's been around for a while. So had you launched Chrome on iOS and it prompted you about it, or you just saw it in the settings?
Yeah, I launched Chrome on iOS and prompted me about it. And I mean, this is partly because I haven't touched iOS in 2.5 weeks because I found that the Nexus 7 was fine, so I hadn't actually picked up the tablets, and there may have just been me catching up on a very old setting, but I hadn't seen that before. Well, that was a
right, was a yeah. This has been out. Well, actually, it looks like there was an article on TechCrunch that Google expands Chrome data compression feature on iOS. Right, and it'll encrypt it as well. Google's begun expanding access to its Chrome data compression feature to more users, specifically those on iOS devices. So they announced this feature quite some time ago, but it looks like they're just rolling out notifications about its iOS availability to more users. So that's what you're seeing, Kevin. You were getting the notification about it. What else? There's some Facebook news, there's some Twitter news. Do you guys want to pick? Should we pick a story? Should we talk about the IPO? Should we talk about I don't know.
I'll give you my favorite Twitter story.
All right, yeah, go for it.
A guy tries to get on an EasyJet flight that's delayed. They're being mean to a passenger, so he tweets a complaint about EasyJet, and they come and tell him he can't get on the plane.
Oh, they stopped him from getting on the plane?
Then he revealed that he's a lawyer, and they made him get on the plane. It's one of the greatest Twitter fails I've ever seen. Can you imagine that? They just come and say, you can't say those things like that, sir. You can't get on this plane then.
Wow, that's amazing. So it wasn't a promoted tweet like the JetBlue, or was it JetBlue, or I forget what
airline
it
was. No, it's just some guy in line. That's all he was doing.
Some guy in line complaining about them being...
yeah, they're being mean to a passenger, so he said something, they told him he couldn't get on. I love that story. I think it's great.
What you say matters, indeed. You know, we talked about Magic Rex. Speaking of Twitter, we talked about the @MagicRex Twitter experiment, I think it was a few episodes ago. And it turns out that, it was British Airways. Thank you, Zach, from the chat room. It was British Airways, the guy complaining about British Airways handling his bag that got promoted.
It says EasyJet here.
No, that was a different story. She's tying together
different stories. So we talked about Magic Rex a few episodes ago, and that's the Twitter experiment where if you follow, you'll get direct messages of recommendations of people to follow and links that got tweeted and news that got tweeted. So it turns out that this was a Twitter experiment. This was an official Twitter experiment. I think maybe it got built during one of their hack days, but they're actually building this into the regular Twitter experience. They're going to start rolling out notifications, mobile notifications of people who you should follow, people who your friends are following. So this is pretty cool. I'm excited.
If they can make it a bit easier to follow, that would be good, because the way it works at the moment is it sends you a DM and then you've got to like click on the link and accidentally not hit the three people it tells you who followed it and then hit follow. So they, if they can tune the UX. But I found it useful. I found it quite handy for finding people who are suddenly like bursting in the news or whatever. Yeah.
It's I've really enjoyed it. But I agree, the DM isn't the best user experience. But this is Twitter for Android, and Twitter for iPhone users will receive these recommendations via push notification. So I imagine if they do it well, particularly on Android, if they use the rich notification, you'll be able to just follow.
Yeah, if they think
no more push notifications, no.
No, but you can change your settings and you can say don't send me these.
Well, let's hope. I like push notifications, so.
If you go into your notification settings, there's a recommendations toggle. You can toggle it off, and you won't get.
That's the problem with getting. It's the other problem with getting a new tablet or a new phone is having to. It's whack-a-mole to find all the notifications and sounds.
Yes.
The sounds that drive me crazy. I think I've got them all. And then bling, bling, bling.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. I spend a good amount of time. I feel like
I can't calibrating find the stuff. Settings.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's. I mean, maybe it's not. Let's see if it's gone. Has it gone out yet?
It's not. There is a notification that's in the Twitter app settings. The only way you can stop it is to like pull down a notification and say, "Android, shut this app up for me, would you?" Because is this the problem? You know, because I've got my own app that does notifications, so I want to turn off the ones from Twitter that are much less useful than the ones I use.
Right.
Because Twitter sends you these ones that like, don't actually expand to show you the whole tweet and. Collapse to say four people said blah and type things, which is just annoying.
Right. At least they stack them. But yeah, no, I'm not seeing it either. It's possible that the update just hasn't gone out yet. If you do prefer the DM, you can just keep following Magic Rex, and that'll keep working the way that it does. Let's see. Facebook launches advanced AI effort to find meaning in your posts. This was interesting to me because my work on ThinkUp. Kevin's laughing.
Lovely headline. I just love that headline. It's like, good luck.
So there's a new research.
I read enough Facebook posts. I can't find meaning in them.
Find meaning in your posts. Well, so this was this is kind of interesting, and it's related to Google in that there's this new research group inside Facebook that's working on building sort of AI into Facebook's so that it can analyze posts to Facebook and recognize people and places and objects a lot how knowledge graphs works on Google and try to get a sense of, you know, do things like sentiment analysis and figure out what has happened to people, what they're talking about, how they feel about it. Of course, probably with the end of boosting their ad targeting. I mean, you know, obviously Facebook has a lot of technology that tries to get the newsfeed to be more relevant, and, you know, ranks newsfeed items, by importance by user. But this is more of like identifying what people are referring to, you know, when you say Java, are they talking about the coding language or coffee?
So it's more like disintermediation and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And they've got.
I don't mean disintermediation. What's the word I mean? Two things that seem alike, but you find out which one's which.
Disambiguation.
Thank you.
Disambiguation. There we go.
Yeah.
No, cause who needs Google when I have you?
Well, that's okay. So I've been reading Clive Thompson's new book. Have you read this yet? Have you seen this?
No, I haven't. What's it called?
His book. It's called Smarter Than You Think.
I'm waiting for him to get in trouble for being optimistic about the net. Yes.
Yes, no, but it's wonderful. It's very good because, you know, Clive always writes really well, and this is like a big part of his wonderful long form thing stuck together in the form of a book. But one of the things he talks about in it is how we discover knowledge and information, and how we actually use each other as repositories for information. So you can ask a question like that and get a response back from people. And he says that the way that that Google is working is trying to be more like that. Than it is like a classic looking up something in the library and going through an automated process. And he says we're very good at adapting to the knowledge that somebody else knows something. So he says if you've got married couples, they will each specialize in remembering one kind of thing. So you know, my wife will remember where we're supposed to be going at the weekend, and I'll remember how to fix computers or something. And we will know that each of us will not bother learning the other thing because we can ask the other about that. And he says that effect is what we're starting to see with Google search, with Wikipedia, with bothering to remember phone numbers, things like that. It's not that the machines are making us stupid or less rigorous. It's just that we're fairly good at optimizing the use of our brains for things and relying on other people and other devices for the bits that we don't need to do. And so that was a fascinating argument. And exactly, you know, what you just did there was the kind of thing.
Pardon me here. Get your drinks ready, folks. Get your cups ready. It's the same thing that Gutenberg did. That before books,
yes,
and before the mass production of books, you had to have things like rhymes to remember things.
Yes.
Because there was no way to write it down easily. Paper was non-existent or expensive. And then we had books to remember things. And we have Google. I do think that there are skills that you learn as to how you remember things that young people today will have different devices to remember things that are different from what mine are, you know, but
he talks about that. Yeah. He talks about Socrates and Phaedrus and that stuff that as well. He also found a great tool, which I will put as a tool later, that's part of the Kindle, that it's called Daily Review. And what it will do is you go to it and it'll give you 10 highlights from a book you read a month ago to remind you what that book was about. And it'll adjust the spacing of these to try and encourage you to remember more from the book. So it's trying to give you more of that classic recall thing. Because part of this is that we're very good at recalling things, that sort of the general gist of things. And over time, the specifics decay. But you can counteract that by rereading and reviewing, which was the point of a commonplace book. So this is a way of turning.
Or you can just Google it.
Like the Daily Review. Time Hop for this reason. Time Hop and ThinkUp has a feature where it says, like, this is what you were thinking about or talking about 2 or 3 years ago on this day. It's this sort of, I haven't asked for it. I haven't said, like, oh, what, you know. Yeah. But I really like those sort of nostalgia apps, those apps, those reminder apps of information that I thought about before, because you get this long-term perspective of, like, oh, this is the trajectory of my thoughts on this thing. Or, like, I was wrestling with that. It sort of makes these connections, and I just remember a lot more. Like, my memory's terrible. But when I get reminded of stuff, and I like that Daily Review, and I should look at it more often for Kindle highlights, because I'm like, oh yeah, that book was so good, and I can connect that piece of information I consumed, you know, 2 years ago to something that's going on in my life right now. And I tend not to look up those things. It's push versus pull.
Yeah.
So, where
are we going with that disambiguation? So the thing that Facebook has is that they do have.
We're also going to memory loss, Kevin, which you just demonstrated as well. But that's okay. I don't need things to remind me what I was thinking 2 years ago, Gina. I need it for 2 minutes ago. Where was I?
Clearly, we all do. There was an awkward pause. Like, wait, what were we talking about?
Where's the back button? That's what we need.
The back button. Sorry.
Well, he has, I'm raving about this book because I'm halfway through it. He has the life logging thing as well, the fascinating effects of that, where you wear a little camera that takes a photograph every 30 seconds, and at the end of the day, you go zoop, and run back through it, and you go, oh, I had a chat with Jeff and Gina today. I didn't remember that. And then it helps you sort of reconsolidate it a bit. So the point for Facebook is that they already have, in the graph stuff, they already have a sort of their own version of what are all the things in the world that people talk about. So I suspect this AI stuff that they're doing is similar to what Google's been doing with whatever that thing that they call the sidebar cards is, to try and make sense of what you're talking about. But they've got the ability, you know, and they've been doing this for a while. When you start mentioning something, it'll go, you know, it'll auto complete it. And you can click it if it's the right one. So they wouldn't make the I'm talking to my friend called Emmy. I'm talking about the Emmys thing mistake unless I actually hit return on the wrong autocomplete there in Facebook. But if people can't be bothered to do that, if people aren't trying to do like the equivalent of an at shout out to somebody, this is going to be one of those things that starts getting interesting when it starts. It's going to be like face recognition photo tagging. Suddenly you'll find it'll start telling you about all these people who are mentioning you who are actually like subtweeting you and trying to snark about you without you realizing what they're saying. So that's going to add an extra dimension of trickiness to this game of how do we grumble about somebody without them realizing we're grumbling about them.
Right. So people will be trying their best to escape Google or Facebook's algorithm for figuring out who they're talking about. But actually, if Facebook does it right, sub tweeting on Facebook won't be possible, right? Because if their algorithm is good enough, they'll know who you're talking about. Even if you haven't autofilled the linked name. When was the last time you guys went? What's up, my Yahoo?
Oh. I only use it, the only time I even think of it, I use it as the example of the silliness, the stupidity of early visions of personalization, of having to fill out a form to get something you want and how we should be actually just listening to people. And there it is. It's just got a new form. It's pretty.
It did. It did. Yeah, pretty, Yahoo has resurrected my Yahoo, and it looks a lot like my Yahoo. I mean, it looks like a bunch of widgets that you put on a page, but maybe redesigned a little better. That's the old my Yahoo, and there's the new my Yahoo. It actually kind of that weather car, that weather widget on the upper left-hand corner looks a lot like Google Now. Now that I'm looking at it.
Yes.
Okay, it didn't ask me to log in. That's the first time I've been to Yahoo in like 3 years. It hasn't asked me to log in. They've actually remembered that I have an account and I'm logged in. That is actually a huge change. No, you remember this, right? They used to expire your cookie in like a week or something. Unless yes. you like, touch
well,
Yahoo every
it
day.
Expired my account. It expired my whole account right. in a year.
Yeah, you have to log in. Is it once a year? Yeah, that's
No.
Okay.
If you didn't use it, they killed. That was the problem. They killed accounts of mine.
Yeah, no, well, that was like Hotmail. They would kill email accounts, yeah.
They would kill email accounts.
Marissa would never do that, I'm sure.
They launched that service where you could actually request a username that you couldn't get, and then if they kill the account of the person with the username, then you could get it, but then you would start getting email to this, other person whose account expired.
That story is actually pretty scary. It's what people predicted you could see, but the story on the rundown that you put there, I think.
Yeah.
Under it. It's the one guy talked about everything he could learn about someone whose old mail is coming to him, and it's a lot.
It's a lot.
And I don't see how you fix that, right? It's namespace, and once the name has been used, how do you can't create a blockade,
right?
For that,
and say right? only deliver mail.
I have that problem anyway. I mean, I get all these Gmails from other Kevin Marxes around the world because I got Kevin Marx at Gmail. So I'm not sure that that's, but yeah, they just made it worse. Okay, this isn't personalized in any way I can recognize. It's giving me the weather in Minneapolis. Why do I care?
have you logged in?
Because Kevin,
in?
It wants to make you feel cocky that you're in much better weather right now. That's why. It's a very California thing.
It looks pretty nice in Minneapolis. It's 73 degrees.
Oh, it is?
Degrees.
Oh.
Yeah, I opened the incognito window. It's giving me San Diego weather. So it actually did no location.
I went there and I'm logged in, but it's decided I'm in Minneapolis. And it's all telling me stuff about American sports that I have no idea what they even stand for. What's NCAA?
NCAA. It's college basketball. Even I know that, Kevin. Come on.
Yeah, even I do, Kevin.
Well, it's just like.
I like the image. I don't know, Chad. You may have dropped this in the rundown. A bunch of people on Twitter were saying, if Marissa Meyer retweets me, I will, stop making fun of Yahoo's new logo in public. And she retweeted them. And if Marissa Meyer retweets this, I will make Yahoo's homepage my homepage. And she retweeted it. So if you go to Marissa Meyer's Twitter, she retweeted a bunch of things of people. I was like, that's really good.
Good for her.
That's really funny.
That's funny.
Really good.
This is like Google Now that has no idea who I am, basically, which I suppose is fair enough, as I haven't actually touched Yahoo in 5 years.
Right, and you have no relationship. But that's why the original vision of giving you it is the mix, right? My newspaper doesn't know where I live or work. It feeds me the same content. Even today, it doesn't give me my county versus counties five. Wait, it's ridiculous. They target ads. They don't target content. So we should have learned this lesson from Yahoo years ago. The problem for Yahoo at the time, of course, was that it had to be explicit. The instruction to it, and we all filled it out and never went back to it. If sites just operated this way by implicitly gaining information about us, like Google does, because we have so much of a relationship with them, then the Yahoo structure is fine. But all that's wrong about it is the form to fill in.
Agreed.
The question is how you feed it useful information.
Right. If you give me enough reasons to use you like Google, then you're going to learn a lot about me.
That's right. True, yeah.
Right, and that's really what Meyer has to do.
And I suppose the thing that Yahoo has done previously is they've let you log in with Google and with Facebook. So potentially that would mean that they could do an OAuth thing and get some more info and feed it into this. So that would make a bit more sense. So certainly in the past, Yahoo has spent a chunk of time trying to make some of this ID integration stuff work. So it may just be because I've got a really old account that I basically keep because it's my Flickr login. I'm just getting not much of anything because I'm not feeding them enough info.
Yeah, I mean, I actually use Flickr quite a bit, mostly to share just photos with my family because I the baby. That's really the only time. In fact, I should log into my Yahoo Mail because I don't want to lose my account. so you referenced this earlier, Jeff. Bomber calls Google a monopoly.
Jesus.
I sort of love that. That Bomber
should
sort
control.
Of, yeah, that authority should control. But, you know, I got to tell you, I read the article. I don't see, this is on The Verge. I don't see the part, and I don't see the quote where he says that authority should control. I think that he said that, I do believe that Google's practices are worthy of discussion with competition authority. We've certainly discussed them with competition authority. So I guess yeah, that implies he thinks that monopoly they should control.
Well, of course, they do this all the time. They've got a whole bunch of front organizations that go up and lobby, you know,
yes,
Congress to say Google is a terrible monopoly and should be regulated, and cookies should be banned, and do not track should exist, and, you know, whatever they feel like. Oh, it's a terrible thing to sue people for certain kinds of patents, but not other kinds of patents, depending on whether you're the kind Microsoft is suing Google over or not. You know, there's a whole pile of like sketchy crap that Microsoft get up to in this arena, and you know, Google have their share of doing slightly annoying things too. But Microsoft have a real track record of being complete dicks about this.
Oh, of course. But what I thought was interesting is that Ballmer was sort of self-congratulating Microsoft for being the only people who are trying to compete with Google. So asked by an analyst how Microsoft can attack Google's dominance in search and advertising, Ballmer explained, "We're the only guys in the world trying with the Bing search engine."
Doesn't really know much about China and Russia then, does he?
Yeah, he doesn't. Very good point. But should we be worried that no one's trying to build search engines anymore? I mean, has Google basically just buttoned up? Do people not care about search anymore because Google's buttoned it up and now it's all about social?
Well, I think search is ready for next generation.
Yeah, you think search is...
We have different kinds of search. That goes back to the Clive Thompson point of, do you know what category of things that you can find on Google? And there's another category of things that you would look somewhere else for. And that's what we're starting to see. So with people, there's a kind of question you would ask Twitter that you wouldn't ask Google. There's a kind of question you would ask Foursquare that you wouldn't ask Google. And when you're asking Twitter, you're not really asking Twitter. You're asking the people that are following you on Twitter.
People who are following you, yeah. But I got to say, with Google Reader, I was like, I don't really use an RSS reader anymore. I do easily a dozen web searches a day on Google. And I switched to DuckDuckGo for a while, but DuckDuckGo was, I think it was Bing on, was it Bing on the back end, or was it other search engines kind of on the back end?
So you've come back, have you? You followed the right children.
Well, I mean, honestly, I do a lot of my searching on my Android device, and you know, that Google search bar is sort of affixed to your home screen, and it's not easy to change to another search engine unless you're running CyanogenMod, interestingly. But you know, between now and, you know, a lot of my searches are Google powered. I had changed my search shortcut to DuckDuckGo, but I sometimes will switch over to Google or type in the Google, you know, bang Google.
Away. Could you try?
Google's good at search. I know that breaking news. Google's good at search.
I was ashamed of you for doubting Google, and now you have returned.
I like choice. I like competition. And it did occur to me reading this Bomber quote, like, you know, there really isn't another U.S. company attempting search the way that, I mean, Microsoft is trying to do search with Bing.
Real competition would be good. The problem is that Microsoft is trying to catch up to Google and to really rethink search in some fundamental ways. I think we're due for that. And Google, which loves to give us relevance and has added in things that are personal, I think it's important. They've certainly advanced search by quietly by many leaps. But there's probably some great inspiration out there, some really bright, you know, Larry Page of the next generation, to rethink it again and cause competition, which would be a wonderful thing.
Right. The new PageRank, the PageRank of the new generation.
Yes.
Facebook had something with Graph Search, but that's still not like that. Graph Search still feels like I'm asking my friends versus I'm going to the library.
Trying to find your friends. I mean, that's the, you know, the point of Graph Search. You say, I want to find, like, you know, people I know in a certain country or whatever, you know, things like it's finding something that you would then go and look at something else for something else of that. But there's places where you would say, okay, I want to search Yelp or I want to search Foursquare because I want to go out for dinner and I don't trust Google's reviews yet, and Google are trying to fix that. But You'd pick one of those over that. And then there are the much more subtle things where you're saying, okay, no, actually, I do want to talk to a subset of people. I don't want to talk to the entire universe. And to some extent, that is the difference between Foursquare and Yelp. Yelp is like, okay, give me a bunch of opinions I don't care about places near me. And Foursquare is, give me a list of people I know and where they've eaten recently and justify that. So I think part of what we'll get is that the thing that Foursquare does beautifully is it tells you why it's recommending that place. It gives you anything underneath that says, your friend Jeff went there and he thinks that the knishes are really good. So if I'm in New York or something like that, that'll be handy. Or it says, you know, your friend Fred went there and you're like, well, Fred, he always eats crap. I don't want to go take his recommendations. Or it says, you know, it gives you like a little bit of justification for why it's in the search results. Whereas Google doesn't really do that. It'll give you like a list of things. You're like, well, okay, that's kind of what I was thinking, but you know, why would I care?
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. And it's extremely powerful. If I'm considering going to a restaurant and I see that five of my friends have been there, I'm much more likely to go there than a place that hasn't. And that's absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly Foursquare. Yeah, yeah.
And that's Foursquare. Yeah, but like I think about the things that I search for. So you know, I code for my day job, and I'm not doing the shows. And you know, I'm on Stack Overflow all the time. I'm googling errors. Yes. I'm looking up code or whatever. I never go to Stack Overflow and search Stack Overflow. I always Google it, and Stack Overflow just has great Google, and it's often Stack that comes up. And I'm like, oh yeah, I recognize that Stack. That's definitely going to be what I need. So I'm still kind of, and I guess this is kind of the equivalent of typing, you know, Facebook into the Google search box in order to get to Facebook. It doesn't really make sense, but it is, Google really is kind of this initial gateway into all the different places. I mean, I love Foursquare, I love Yelp, I love Stack. I search the PHP documentation all the time, you know, or the Java doc or the Android doc, but I don't know those URLs off the top. I search from Google and go from there.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, so you say about one of the things that I lost when they killed Reader was that Reader had that search bar that would search all the things you'd subscribe to, which was really, really nice. It was like constrain the search to things that have already gone by in your feed. And I found that really handy.
That is very powerful.
And that's a piece... Oh, you know,
we're back to the Reader morning.
No, but the point is, it's search over history. It's search over my history. It's a bunch of stuff that I've read over the last 7 years. And I vaguely remember reading a thing. You know, it's like I was saying about the Amazon thing. I vaguely remember reading a thing about that. Give me some direction here, because if I search the entire web, I won't find it. But I want to constrain it to the set of things that I've seen. And Google throwing away the list of stuff that I'd seen in that particular space is short-sighted. That, you know, rather than it saying, oh, okay, how do we expand that experience to a bunch of other people rather than just this? That's, you know, that's what they're missing. And I think Facebook and Twitter having those longitudinal histories of stuff we've looked at will be. Have a better chance of that, unless Google can really get all of us using Plus.
Yeah, I mean it's a close equivalent to Amazon, you know, deleting your son's notes and highlights from all his books because of the account mix up. I mean it's similar to that.
No, I mean I've exported them whatever, but I don't think when I exported it, I got all the articles I'd read.
Right.
I just got the you know.
The stuff that you liked and shared.
That database was there and it was searchable and it was actually really useful.
Yeah.
Because they had the database of all the blog posts that I'd read ever.
Yep. So are there any other stories that we should hit before we move on to our...
Good job, Hayden. Good job. I think you got us through really the good stuff.
Without the technical
difficulties. Well, I do have to mention one thing, of course.
Yes.
It's still not connected. 63 days after the Nexus 7 was announced, 16 days after it went on sale, it's still not connected. Bupkis from Verizon, they're not saying crapola. I've gone to the FCC, as you know, last week. Verizon did answer me and say, oh, we have to certify. But I still say that's not openness. That's not just putting the device on the way you can do all across Europe. So I responded to the FCC. I'm going to keep after the FCC on this. I remain enraged. And people keep on saying to me, why don't you just take the SIM out of your Pixel and then go take it to the store and get another SIM in there? Because it's a matter of principle. I'm fighting for you, people. I'm fighting for openness.
this is the nerd answer, right? I think this was like episode 3 where you yes, were talking about something and you said, Gina, aren't you bothered by this? I was like, no, because I'll be able to find a technical workaround, right? Which is a really yes. short-sighted view. So for them to say, hey, man, just take out the SIM, use the T-Mobile, what's the big deal? Right, this is a matter of principle. You're fighting the good fight. So has Verizon given a date, an estimated date, just say soon?
So I know what's going to happen. I really don't understand their end game. I really honestly don't, because at some point they're going to have to approve this. It's obviously certified. If they don't, then that kills the notion of openness, because it operates all around the world, including its competitors, AT&T, T-Mobile. That's why there should be no certification. What we need here is a clarification from the FCC of the rules, because certification and openness don't match. If it's open, that means you can take any device that's been certified by the FCC that works on networks and put a SIM in it, and it should work automatically the way it does on AT&T, T-Mobile, and all across Europe and the rest of the world. And so it's the FCC rules are going to have to be clarified, thus changed, to say, no, Verizon, this is what openness means. O-P-E-N, right? It's like Bill Clinton talking about the definition of is. They got to figure this out here. So I just want to give the update here. I'm going to continue fighting the good fight, people.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome, Jim.
We appreciate it. I think we may have a word from Kevin. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Sorry. It just reminded me, because you know, having done the trip to the UK for 2 weeks and spending a lot of time moving SIMs around, that was, you know, the experience there is fascinating, because you can get a SIM for, you know, they're at the counter in the convenience store. You can recharge them anywhere. You can buy cigarettes or chocolate. You can get a new SIM for a different provider, similarly anywhere there. All the phones are presumed to be unlocked. If they aren't unlocked, the official phone shop will say, there's a guy around the corner, just go and talk to him, and he will download a hack from the net and exploit your phone and lock it for you. But they actually are pushing really hard to censor the net. And even, you know, The Guardian published sort of, you know, some rotten survey by a filtering company that says 50% of... It's terrible. Almost 50% of Wi-Fi things aren't filtered. It's like, Jesus Christ, 50% of them are filtered? That's horrific. And I did find that there is this sort of strange culture of, no, we must like censor the net to protect the British public from it. And I did find that, you know, when I was using Wi-Fi places, some of them were blocking SSH and IRC and things. And
really?
And VPNs, yeah. So there is a, you know, so they have an openness on one layer, and then they have this sort of weird, like, yeah, as you say, lacking a First Amendment censorship thing going on there.
Yes, exactly.
And certain sites do not show up at all. If you go to...
That's appalling.
If you go to Pirate Bay in the UK, then you get a, I'm sorry, we've been told by the government you can't see this page on many of the ISPs.
And the GCHQ is coming after you right now. Just yep. Stay there, sir. They'll be there soon.
Still, yes.
They're going to blow up your machine. Oh, speaking of which, Chad, would you mind just going to my Google Plus feed and look for the photo of Alan Rusbridger there? Rusbridger spoke in New York last week, and this is the editor of The Guardian. And as you remember, folks, the GCHQ, the NSA of the UK, how's that for a lot of initials, came in and destroyed Guardian laptops, even though Rusbridger said straight out, this data from Edward Snowden is elsewhere. It's at the New York Times. It's in Brazil. This is really rather absurd, but they destroyed it. So Rusbridger was a great woman. He brought along a little, I think it was there it is. So that's what all the best-dressed editors wear. There's a piece of the computer, and it's amazing. Up close, you can see the drill marks going over and over and over again. They went berserk to destroy it, absolutely berserk.
Wow.
That's what was left of the Guardian computer. That piece is
destroyed
like that.
Destroyed computers. Is that? Did he make it a lapel clip, or is he just holding it up?
No, he was joking. We were joking that he ought to.
Yes.
And so he put it there.
It is a badge of honor. He should be wearing it like a medal.
He should be wearing it. That'd be some good jewelry right there. Wow.
Yeah, there he is holding it. And that's the more stern Alan. Yes, wow. You can call him Alan Rusbridger. Go ahead and put his name in there, Chad. Yes.
Oh, it's prompting the name tag.
Yeah, it's through the. So wow. Anyway, sorry. Okay. Cool. So
I think we're saying maybe we have. We might have a word from our sponsor via Leo, disembodied Leo from vacation.
Hey, everybody. Sorry I couldn't be here for Twig, but I am here for the ad. How about that, huh? Gina, you're doing a great job. You're beautiful, kid. Don't ever change. This show is brought to you by our friends at Hover.com. Actually, I love coming back to talk about Hover because, first of all, Elliot Noss and his crew at Two Cows are great guys, great people. And one of the things that they're really about is taking businesses, industries, and making them work better. And you know, solutions, companies that are broken, like the cell phone industry with Ting and the domain name registration industry with Hover.com. Hover is the best domain name registrar of all. I use it all the time now. When I first started using Hover, I used their concierge service, got all my domains moved over. Couldn't have been easier. In fact, I highly recommend that. Now they offer, besides easy, simple-to-use domain name registration, very, very nice domain management tools, friction-free purchases. They also offer Google Apps. So this is kind of cool. Now, for your business or even from, you know, your family or for your group, Google Apps.
Google Apps offers a full...
use Google Apps here. And you can set it all up through Hover.com. So get a domain name that'll be your Google App domain. You have this. You can try it for 30 days free. You'll get Google Mail, Google Calendar, Google Drive, Google Docs, the whole package. You could use it on an existing domain. They can help you do that. But, you know, because they have the Laporte family Google App domain, you know, Laporte family or whatever. I wish I had thought of this, actually, before I sent the kids off to college. You get 25 gigs of storage, of course, on Gmail. And it's easy to collaborate with file sharing and chatting. Google, maybe not. We talked about this the other day. Not the easiest company to get a hold of for support. But this is what's great about it. You'll get the outstanding support of Hover, the no-hold support of Hover, best in the industry, and Google Apps. So it's a great combination. I want you to try Hover. So here's the deal. If you visit Hover.com, you can try it out by pick a domain name. You know, something that you're thinking of buying. They offer all the big domain names, .com, .net, .org, .tv, .pro, .mobi, .biz. They have .io, which is a fun one. Country codes, too, like .ca, .asia, .us, .uk. If you go in there and you enter a name, and you don't be disappointed if the .com's not there. Pretty commonly, it's not. They do recommend, and I agree, .net is a great choice. People understand .net. It's kind of the next best thing to .com. But they'll offer you all the different choices, and you can see what you like. I would look at .net. Hover offers excellent online help, great support, documentation, tutorials, everything you need. And again, that no hold, no wait, no transfer phone support is fabulous. When you call during regular business hours, you're going to talk to a live agent who's empowered and eager to help. Hover, you want to try it? Here we go. Here's the deal. Go to hover.com/twig. That's our special page. You'll see my smiling face. Hover.com/twig. And to get 10% off your first domain registrations, you're going to use the offer code TWIG, T-W-I-G. The 10% offer applies to standard domains only, not premium domains. That's hover.com/twig. Use the offer code TWIG to get 10% off. And hey, a tip of the hat to Hover. We love them. We thank them for supporting This Week in Google. All right, Gina. Let's continue on with This Week in Google. See you guys later.
Thank you, Leo. Right on. So let's wrap it up with our tip, tool, and number of the week. I guess I'll get started. Google has made Quick Office for Android and iOS free for everyone. So in the Google Play Store or the iTunes Store, you can download Quick Office, which means that you'll be able to edit Microsoft Office documents and spreadsheets and presentations on the go without paying a dime. But the tip is, if you download Quick Office for Android or iOS right now, between today, the 25th, September 25th, or tomorrow, the 26th, and you sign in into your Google account through Quick Office, you will get 10 gigabytes of free Google Drive space for 2 years. So grab the app. It's Quick Office. You can search for it in the Play Store or the App Store. Download it onto your device. Sign in with it. And for the account that you sign in with, your Google account you sign in with, you'll get 10 gigabytes of free Google Drive space, which is a nice little upgrade. That offer is only good today and tomorrow by September 26th. So you can get on that now. A little extra space. Never hurt anyone.
Question,
also,
Gina,
Quick Office is a pretty good app.
Quick Office. Yeah, and why don't you think it's on a Chrome app yet?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question.
Granted, they have docs, but if you could bring some of this functionality and the ability to easily edit Word docs and such that Quick Office has to a Chrome app that interoperates with your Drive, that'd be cool.
Yeah, I don't know why all these features aren't just built into Drive, right? Like, I use the Drive app on Android.
True. Yes.
Right, why they wouldn't just build it into Drive to begin with? So I don't know. I don't know what this promotion's kind of about.
Well, maybe they changed the strategy. This was meant to be a premium sell up to apps people and such. Maybe now that it's free, they will.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Maybe. But
I suspect they will eventually merge these. But the thing is that Microsoft documents are such a rat's nest of legacy nonsense that it's very, very hard to make sense of this, and merging those code bases would probably take a really long time. So having alternative solutions may make more sense. The Microsoft guys have trouble keeping this stuff straight, and they have the source code.
Right.
And Docs does, and Drive does work well.
Drive does a fairly good job, but it still tends to do server-side rendering rather than translating to something you can edit half the time. But you can usually read something. Yeah.
Right. I was in a Best Buy store the other night, and there was a couple there asking about the Chromebook for the guy, and the Best Buy blue shirt is up on the thing. And can you store anything here? He says, no, you can't store anything. So I step in like Marshall McLuhan in the Woody Allen movie. I say, no, actually, you can store these things. And I do a sales pitch for the Chromebook there for 10 minutes and tell them just to use Drive. And they said, oh, yeah, we like Drive. It's fine. So I said, then you'll love it. Get it.
Nice. Google should hire you. We need a blue shirt. You can just sell it.
Gina, from your lips to their ears. We're going to get a new dean at the school. You don't know what's going to happen.
You don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. So, Jeff, your number of the week.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a different one than I thought. We talked about the Time cover story last week by Harry McCracken and company. And so he put up a blog post of 10 things you didn't know about Google. And I'm just going to give you the first one because it's the number of the week. We're going to do Google's phone number. Page told him that when Google started on University Avenue with about 30 employees, they accidentally put their phone number up on the web. This reminds me of May Day on Amazon. So we had 30 people, and I'm quoting now from Page, and we already had millions of users. We accidentally published our phone number on our website, and our phone number was just unusable. We had to get a new one then because people just started calling us. And there's only 30 of us. We couldn't even answer the phone for millions of people, but we could run a website. I think that shows you the incredible multiplication factors you get with technology. You can easily run a website for millions of people with a small group, but you can't run a phone number with that many people. So that's the number of the week, Google's phone number.
I like it. I like it. That's a really good point.
Who got the number next when they abandoned it?
Yes. I must admit, I did watch the internship on the flight over and laughed out loud at the fact that the idea that one of their jobs was answering the phone for complaints for Google.
Yes.
Yes. <It's> like,
that was the funniest thing in the movie, which was like, oh,
no, I know, do that. The impression that there were support people all there ready to answer your questions about Chrome. Oh, very cool. All right, Kevin, your thing, your tool.
I have two things. One that was like a follow-up from the previous thing, which just reminded me. So there's a tweet, which I think I just threw in there, which is just amusing me because it was a Nikesh Arora, who's the chief business officer for Google, tweeting out, help, I need to remove the contact lock on my phone. I don't have a UK credit card and I can't find a T-Mobile store. It's like, I found three on Google, but maybe, you know, maybe his contact lock was bad enough he couldn't use search Google Maps. So that was, yeah, but the sort of slightly more serious link from that is the Open Rights Group link, which is blocked.org.uk, which is where you report the wrong things being blocked on your mobile phone. So if you are in the UK and you try and do something and you find it's not working, go there and report it so that the open rights group can collate them and stop even more stupid censorship being imposed.
I haven't seen Noder.
So this is my standing up and publishing my stuff from XOXO. So Noter Live is a very, very hacky tool that I wrote to do the kind of live tweeting that I do. And I wrote it as one of the indie webcam hacks, and I used it quite a lot over at XOXO. And what it does is very simple. You log in with Twitter, you put in a hashtag. It's not going to look great unless you actually zoom in a bit. You put in the hashtag and name of the person, and then you just keep typing the tweets in and hitting return, and it posts them in that format. And then there's a change speaker button that lets you type in someone else's Twitter handle, look that up. And the idea of this is it means that I can do the kind of live tweeting that I do more quickly, but also the hope is that over time it will gain the ability to collate those tweets into something that I can post to a blog post or something else, rather than just disappearing into Twitter and only being able to get them out when I do the download my tweets thing. So that's my little tool there. And the source is up on GitHub, and if people want to help try it out or send me bug reports or patches, I'm very happy to get them.
Very cool. And you use Node.
I use Node for it, yeah. Node's very good for these like quick and dirty little web things. Node and Heroku together make a good combination.
Yep. Very cool. I have starred your repository. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Kevin, for joining us today. I was a little nervous about filling Leo's giant shoes, the Dr. Evil chair, but it was really good to have you on the show, have a familiar face who's been on the show. Do you have anything else that you want to plug? What's going on with Tunnelvision or Salesforce or anything else you want to tell us about?
Not a lot directly. I mean, the interesting thing about Tunnelvision is that the other reason that I like Clive's book was that he mentions Tunnelvision a couple of times, which is very nice. I did see Deb over the weekend, and we keep saying we should start this again, but at the moment it's still in hiatus.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you, Jeff. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun, as usual.
Always wonderful. Great work, Gina. You kept things going at a pace, and we covered a lot.
Thank you. Yeah, we did. Yeah, barring the Skype technical difficulties, it was a lot of fun. I don't feel like I totally filled the big chair, but we made it. I hope Leo's having a really, really good vacation.
And I want people to know, I said in the chat room, there was a period in the beginning where Kevin and I talked a lot, which we normally do a lot, but we really talked a lot. Gina's Skype went down. That's why. So I thought we weren't
trying to shut her up.
At keeping going. We do that very well, but that was a point where we were trying to vamp.
Thank you very much. You sound like you were totally Cylon, and you sounded like drowned robots. I couldn't understand anything, and I hung up, and then we were reconnecting on Skype. So thank you for filling that in, you guys. And yeah, no, they weren't. Kevin and Jeff were not blocking me out of the conversation.
We've been known to do it, but that time we weren't.
Well, thank you so much. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. I don't know UTC off the top. But thank you, guys. We'll be back next week. And thank you to Chad for doing an expert job switching the show, as usual. Thank you, everyone. See you next week.